disrupted the connections from back here to here. And he had a disorder called dissociative visual agnosia, where he could not recognize objects visually. So if he held up a column, he said, what is it? He said, I have no idea. He said, well, guess. I don't know, shoe? He actually got the colors. Interesting. No, try it again. I have no idea. You reach for it. As soon as he's asked to reach for it, he reaches unerringly. The spatial stuff's absolutely intact. As soon as he touches it, he says, oh, it's a comb. Okay? So right away, you know, there's more than one kind of memory going on here. The visual stuff didn't get in. The tactile stuff did. And once it got in, via the modality-specific tactile memories, you could get to this labeled kind of stuff. Say it's a comb, probably knew you used it to comb your hair, stuff like that. So memory's not one kind of thing. It's going to be important. This is from Pat Goldner-Kish. It's not that the information stops in the posterior parietal lobe, the Ware system. It actually projects to the frontal part, under the frontal one, in an area that's critically involved in working memory. You all know working memory. I heard Manny mention it before. Okay. So there are neurons here that serve to retain information about spatial location even when the thing is removed, the short-term memory. It's interesting. It's right next to this area, which is area A in the monkey brain, which is the frontal eye field. It's used in voluntary shifting of attention. So what's happening is information is going to frontal lobes are critically involved in decision making. Okay, if you look at a human brain versus a monkey brain, the human brain has all the stuff sitting out the front the monkey brain doesn't. Why is that? My own view is that the brain is a parallel machine. Okay? It is. Just like it's awkward to do the kind of neural network modeling that we've heard about on a serial computer. Because you've got to kind of do a little this, a little that, a little this, and a little that. It's not really parallel. Simulating a parallel process in a serial machine, the brain has the reverse problem. It's trying, it has to do serial processing on a parallel machine. So one of the things that humans do a lot better than monkeys is talk. Okay? Frontal lobes are critically involved in speech production. They're also critically involved in fine motor control. It's at least in my view, the key thing the frontal lobes are up to, making decisions, using information that's sort of in this little cache memory, coming from the Ware system, help you decide what to do next, like where to look next. Now, it's not just information about where it is, you also have information about what it is. This is also from Goldner-Kish's lab. So here we have the eye. Here's V1, first visual area, the one that had the nice topography you saw. You get this projection of the posterior parietal lobes, spatial vision, so-called Ware system. It goes to the frontal lobes, the region of the principal sulcus. And meanwhile, you have in parallel, down in the inferior temporal lobes, object vision, the so-called wet system. Okay, that projects the inferior convexity. It turns out in later work, it's shown that in fact there's a continuum of neurons here. The ones at the very top respond only to location, the ones at the very bottom only to shape. About 50% respond to conjunctions, only conjunctions, shapes in particular locations. It's just what you want in order to use information to direct you if it's an interesting shape, to a particular location. How do you know it's an interesting shape? Well, not shown in this diagram, she wasn't interested in it. There are also massive connections bridging these two areas, which we call the temporal polysensory area, right here, which seems to be an associative memory. It's associating where objects are and what they are and storing them in memory. So the fact that you can tell me, presumably, where the furniture is in your living room, just the mere fact you can do that shows somewhere in memory what and where have been cross-indexed, or where things are on your desk. Got to be cross-indexed. It's this kind of associative memory, which is in this so-called junction area in large part, which is indexed via the various sensory modalities, via touch, my patient with a comb, or if a cat, if you hear a cat meow, you can identify it as a cat, just like you can see it, or if you feel it rub against your shins. So different sensory modalities leading to this associative memory, this multimodal. And it's by looking up those associations that you know when you see an apple that has seeds inside. You can't see the seeds, but by digging into memory, you've got the association that has seeds inside. Similarly, you can know whether, if you're hungry, you ought to be looking at that apple and maybe thinking about approaching it, which is frontal lobe stuff. That will make use of information from long-term memory. All right, to summarize. So here's the framework, a functional story. It's basically these kind of results. I wrote a book, it was published in 1994, so it's a page from the brain, which basically this documents the rationale behind this diagram, in large part. It breaks them down more finely, but here's the basic idea. In perception, information comes into the back of the brain. There's a set of these topographically mapped areas. Information can tell you that most of the connections are very short and inhibitory in these topographically mapped areas. So it helps to find the inhibiting, sharpens things by inhibiting where there's a transition from light to dark. You can't process all the information in these in detail. Attention is the selective aspect of information processing. If some region of space is picked up, you attend to it. You can do this covertly. You don't have to move your eyes, but usually you do, but you can't do it covertly. Attention gets mapped to visual memories, the matched visual memories in the object properties processing system. If there's a good match, you've recognized it. So recognition is where you know it's familiar. You've seen something like that before. If you recognize it confidently, you can then identify it. Identification is where you get out associations with it. Okay, that it's a cat that likes to chase mice, eat cheese. Mice and cheese. Cats drink milk. So we have associative memories. We've got the long-term associative memories in the junction area. We also have this frontal lobe one, which is sort of keeping on line what's happening at the time, which object you recognize and where it is. So you're getting the where information over the entire visual field. So you know there's something there, so you can move your eyes to it even before you know what it is. Okay, now, what happens if you see something like this? See this hand? Not a very good hand. It may not match very well down here. In which case, the frontal lobe systems are going to run to completion. Everything's running at once. It's not like a computer where you do a little of this, wait until it's finished, and it goes on. Frontal lobe systems shunt information. So if you've got a mediocre match to a modality-specific memory, so you have a visual one, you've got an auditory one hanging off here, so forth, they're all leading into this associative memory, long-term associative memory. If there's a mediocre match, you may look for a distinctive feature, say, well, if it's a hand, I should be able to find a thumb. So you looked up, this is very important to the story I want to tell. You've looked up in long-term, oh no, and I can't get back to that? You looked up in long-term associative memory, from this frontal lobe system.
If you look at the keyboards.
Just a minute, it's getting backwards. Better on the right.
No, just making it go forward.
I tried Asia.
There, it works. Okay. Thank you. Alright, in perception, we're active view. We don't just sit here like a sponge on a rock waiting for somebody to drift by and, you know, slurp it down. As soon as we get a sense of somebody out there that might be relevant or interest, we actively seek information about it. That's done via these frontal lobe systems that look up a distinctive information about what it is and prime you. At the same time, you shift your attention, which involves various, it's actually quite an elaborate system involving shifting your attention. This priming activity of carrying you in a stream will actually form a visual mental image by literally projecting backwards these areas. I've done a ton of work on this. I'm not going to tell you about any of it. Yeah.
Do you understand time sequencing for that?
No, that's something that George and I are working on with something called transcranial magnetic stimulation, where we can put a pulse in briefly that will disrupt one area, and we can vary the timings. We've just started doing this kind of stuff. But that's a very good question to ask, and given the tools we're currently using, mostly fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, you don't get the temporal resolution. You have to do it in conjunction with something else. Excellent question. But that's obviously predictions that come from this, clearly. That, you know, the last NIH grant, it's a test. It's activated before that's activated. Okay? The imagery should be the other way around. Perception should be that way. So it should be clear interaction. We'll find out. Stay tuned. For working memory, the idea is that this information shunting process, which is something like what now they call the executive, uses information long-term associative memory to store. This is a Bentley had this idea of a visual spatial sketch pad. We want to break it in half. Say the visual part is actually using the what system shape. If you need high resolution, you actually go backwards and reconstruct an image. Whereas spatial is using the primal lobes. So there should be another arrow coming down here, which is missing. Okay, that you should be able to take information, chill, and know whether it's relevant or not. So working memory is all about operating on information in order to accomplish some task. So you've got A, what the task is. B, what information is relevant. C, when to recall what particular information is short-term memory. D, how to operate on it. Complicated, really complicated. So you've got to be accessing constantly things in the long term. It's going to be part of the working memory system in order to be able to operate on. So in terms of deception work, here's the part that's relevant. Okay. Any questions about this before I go on? Because everything else hinges on this story. If I could, I'd have this up there, the second projection, sort of hanging around. Is it relatively clear what we're trying to do here? Yes? So if I ask you a fact, what color is false? Your car is blue. It's to actively access long-term associative memory, store directly. My car is blue. You just exit. You have a match, and you can just somebody process it and talk about it, allow you to respond. But let's say I ask you true or false. A cat has pointed ears. Does a cat have pointed ears? Your eyes are slightly to the side there. In that case, you probably didn't have it stored explicitly. And instead, what you did is activated your visual memory, and probably even reconstructed it so you had another image. Okay. So for retrieval, the notion is if it's really well learned, just be able to activate it. If it's not that well learned, it's going to take more effort to sort of reconstruct it. If you're making it up on the spot, then you may, in fact, be imagining things, trying to make it seem coherent, trying to literally wing it as you go along. So the different set of processes will be involved. In particular, predictions are, when we look at spontaneous lies versus rehearsed lies, we expect more working memory and more imagery for spontaneous lies. Why? Because it's spontaneous. You have to actually remember what the truth was, not say the truth, it's going to inhibit that. You come up with something else you think is plausible. That's a lot of computation. Working memory is going to be involved, frontal lobe systems, as well as activating the associative memory. And in many cases, people report that they actually visualize alternative scenarios and use their visualization. Okay, so that's one prediction to pick up. Another is for rehearsed lies versus truth. So now they're both, this is rehearsed and coherent. They're both stored in associative memory. We expect different frontal lobe structures, at least different activation of frontal lobe structures, to be harder. Truth you've learned well, it's really integrated in a way that rehearsed lies aren't, at least the amount of rehearsal we gave. So the frontal lobe structures that are involved in digging out information, they have to work harder. And the temporal areas that are involved in storing the modality-specific visual information may be accessed because it's not as well learned as associative memory. You may have to sort of use a little bit of this imagery to reconstruct it. That's where we started. That's what we got. Here's the approach. So prior to scanning, we obtained detailed reports from memory of two events, a vacation and a birthday party, I think we two. Vacation and work event. Actually, we went back before. I'll say about this more in a second. So real memories. We got detailed protocols, pages and pages. We prepared a recorded list of statements. That's prior scanning. Come in for a session for the scanning. Okay, the day of the fMRI scanning, there were two extreme lie conditions, spontaneous and well-rehearsed coherent. There were two truth conditions, initial, first time to hear it, and then a second time was repeated. So we wanted to look at the effects of basically rehearsing and memorizing a response per se. There were two response modes where they actually got a statement, your car was blue, true or false, or what color was your car, but they had to produce a word. Collapsing over that, it was kind of amazing. We thought that the spoken version, they might move too much and mess up the scan. It didn't look like it happened. But we have not carefully analyzed the difference between these two yet. But on eyeball, it looks like it may not be important. These are preliminary analyses. In some ways, the individual subject data are more interesting than the group data. But the key thing we're focusing on was the idea that there's more than one kind of lie, and different neural systems underlie different kinds of lie situations.
Not quite sure what you did.
All right, not yet. All right, so what do we do? True fMRI is a memory questionnaire. One is about work, vacation, and the other is about work. So they get two in advance. And they fill out in great detail. So vacation, we went to the desert. How did you get there? We drove. What kind of car was it? Well, it was really a station wagon. What color was it? Blue. Who did you go with? I mean, you know, just really, really detailed. Same thing about work. We then formulated questions, half were true, half were false. By questions, half of them were actually statements, half were actually questions. So on one condition, they're asked, what color was your car? OK, Okay, it's relevant because what they told us they drove there in a conversation wagon to be. These are customized for each person. Obviously, it's their own memories. We recorded the questions. This is all done before they come in for fMRI. Then fMRI, the day, we first review their memories, so they're fresh in mind about the two events. We then sit down, this is the critical part, we pick one of them, this is counterbalance, and we generate an alternative reality. We say, okay, let's go through that vacation. Let's imagine a totally different vacation. Alright? Instead of the desert, you went to the forest. And instead of driving, you flew there. Instead of going to your parents, you went alone. Alright, let's learn this. We have them memorizing things. They actually fill out a form with the alternative reality. They memorize it until they can repeat it back. Okay? This is a set of lies. It's coherent. It's held together. We then give them a practice session. So they know they're going to have to lie in terms of using the alternative reality to respond instead of the truth or tell the truth. So they're scanned with different instructions. And then we have the fMRI scan. In the fMRI scan, they're in the machine, it's a very hostile environment, the door's about this big, you're in stuff all the way in there, if you're claustrophobic, forget it. If you move more than about that much, forget it, emotional artifacts. This is not going to be a practical tool, let's get that really clear up front. They're looking at a prism mirror kind of thing and a projector. Actually, we use an auditory presentation of this. This one was completely auditory, their eyes are closed. And they're hearing over headphones statements. The car that you're going through vacation is blue, and they have to either push a button true or false, or in another condition, what color would your car to say the answer? We record a microphone. Okay, so let's show you some results. So these are average data. You see here on the top. Let me get you oriented. The eyes will be here. So this is the back of the brain. This is the frontal part of the brain. This is the temporal lobe. This is the human brain now, not monkey brain. So you can see, there's all this stuff in the front that wasn't on monkey. A lot more wrinkles. We're a lot smarter than monkeys. Okay. So I wish the screen were bigger. What we've got here is four conditions. Rehearsed lies, they're always in the same order. Spontaneous lies, the lies are on the left, rehearsed and spontaneous.
What were spontaneous lies, and what did you tell them?
Just the spontaneous lies, if you're given a statement, if you're asked what color is your car, just lie. Okay. When you hear a statement, push the other button. You know, lie. So nothing about using an alternative reality to generate the answers.
But they knew which questions they were to lie.
Yeah, they're told, in this condition, we want you to lie in response to every one of the questions. Okay? And that's spontaneous. Or in this condition, we want you to use the alternative reality to generate lies for every one of these questions. Or in this condition, we want you to tell the truth.
So when they're supposed to lie, they were supposed to use a response that wasn't in the alternative reality or...
There are different scenarios, so it's counterbalanced. So they only get, if the vacation was the one we built the alternative reality with, they only get that in the reverse line condition. That's all counterbalanced over subjects. Otherwise, it would be impossible. Alright, so here's what you find. The lines are always the two on the left. It's alphabetical order, reverse spontaneous, the two on the right are true. Alright, what we've got here is percent signal change, and the Giorgio, you're going to correct me on anything I said wrong. The heavy red is the mean, and all we've got graphs here are cases where there were significant differences. So first thing to note is that if we compare the spontaneous lies with the other conditions, you're getting more activation in a frontal lobe area that's critically involved in looking up information from episodic memory. This is part of Endel Tolving's Carol story, if you're familiar with that. So there's an area, Robin's area 9, VA is Brodman's area. Brodman was this guy who cut up brains in his kitchen sink, and he labeled the areas in the order in which he sliced them. And that's where the system came from. It's really, it makes sense to use the random numbers. But that's where we're still using it. So here we've got this area that is activated. You're telling spontaneous lies. Brodman's area 9 is involved in working memory. Ed Smith and these other characters have pointed out that in working memory, you get activation, particularly on the left side of the verbal. in this area of Robbins Area 9. Why did I confuse that with 10? Because that's the next slide. Robbins Area 10 is critically involved in looking up information. This is the one that Emil Tobin has talked about, and that's the information in long-term memory. And what you look here, now it's rehearsalized condition that is showing the most activation. So the idea was that for spontaneous lies, you need working memory. This Robbins Area 9 crucially involved in that frontal shunting area, holding it online. Because for rehearsed lies, you've got to dig it out, okay, of long-term associative memory. In fact, this is more activated than the other areas were. As I'm whizzing through this, please notice these other lines. These are individual subject data. One of the things I want to emphasize is even though the means are coming out looking fairly plausible, there's enormous individual differences. Something I really think has to be emphasized. Enormous individual differences. So here you have the actual data, graph for each subject. Look at some of them actually came down. Okay, there were 9 subjects coming here. The Polinar is involved in attention.
Who were the subjects?
The subjects were Harvard students, ages, I think, 18 to 30, if I remember right, something in that order. Yeah, there's a lot of things down. Sort of an uneven gender distribution. Well, obviously, there's 9 subjects to win. We try to get that in there. This, I want to emphasize, is really preliminary. This is really, it's an approach. Richard, you stretch me out a question.
I don't know whether to ask it now, but did they, do you learn anything more from this analysis than the response rates?
You know, we're just analyzing response rates now. That's an extremely good question. You can ask me in about a week. So what you're asking is this going to take longer to answer why when they don't. My data is they probably do, but there's overlap in distributions. That's my data. We'll see. Polinar is involved in attention. It's it could be involved apparently in focusing attention. Left fusiform gyrus is part of the wet system. It's involved in visual memory. You notice the 2 lie conditions were more activated than either of the truth conditions. Apparently what happens when you're lying, you actually dip into more different types of memory. So it appears.
Okay, the last statement you just made.
Both types of lies.
Yeah, now the last statement you made that relates to something I've just been sitting here thinking about. So that difference, that lack of difference in the last slide.
Yeah. Okay.
Didn't surprise me, but I don't know if it didn't surprise me for the right reasons.
Okay, one of the things I want to emphasize that I might as well emphasize now, there isn't going to be a single center, a single place that if it lights up, it's on a spontaneous lie, or a rehearsed lie,
or
whatever. It's going to be a set, it's going to be a configuration. So the whole system is operating in a slightly different mode and they're engaged in different kinds of activities.
Perhaps you've covered this, but you know, I was sitting here thinking of your example, you know, tell somebody, lie to me about the next question.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first I'm going to activate my card
right.
And its color. Then I'm going to have to think of it deliberately, think of a different color.
Exactly.
And how does that map onto these 2 different areas?
The idea is that if you haven't thought about it and stored it very well explicitly, okay, in associative memory, as a verbal statement, you may have to really visualize, activate modality-specific visual memories which are stored in temporal lobe. This is the wet system. Okay. So those are modality-specific associative memories we have in there. Okay, so what we're showing here is areas that are different than the other areas. So what we're not showing is areas that live in common. So associative memory areas are live in all these spots. Okay, this is important. This is an area that has been shown to be critically involved in error monitoring errors. Okay, so an error correction. Jonathan Cohen and a bunch of other people have done a lot of work on this. And what you see is, in spontaneous lies, the anterior cingulate is more activated than it is in the other areas, which makes perfect sense. Your initial impulse is to start thinking what the truth is, and you got to force that down. Okay, the anterior cingulate is playing a critical role in that forcing down process apparently. And because you've rehearsed these lies, it's not doing such a job, it doesn't seem to be anymore.
That particular one looks much more systematic across individuals.
Well,
than, for example, the previous one.
Look at these. Look at these. You still see these people are trying to help. No,
they're not. Group, they're not.
Specific lies.
these are each subject.
Right. So
but this
condition right there.
That's right. Not. It's true. You're right.
That's the one of all the ones you've shown so far
there is
where you suppress a lot of individual variables.
That's correct. That's correct. Okay, so how great are these individual differences? I've only got six more slides to go. There's individual people. What I want to do is show you data from individuals and to show you that, in fact, it's not just a quantitative difference, there appear to be strategy differences. Okay, so these are different colors to remind you you've seen something different now. Okay, these are individual people. So what you see here, this is an fMRI study where there's 30 seconds of nothing happening, 30 seconds where they're asked to participate in a task, 30 seconds of nothing, so it's an on-off. These are called boxcars. This on, off, sorry, off, on, off, on, those are called boxcars. Okay, and what you're seeing here is the signal strength. The white is when they're doing spontaneous lie. The dark, which is not showing up very well as this projector, is when they're telling spontaneous truth. And what you see here on this slice, this is seen from the side, this is from the brain. This is the primary visual area, V1 in the back of the brain. You're seeing a lot of activation for this one person all the way in the back of the brain. Why? If you interview people afterwards, some of them tell you in the spontaneous lie condition they visualize. If you visualize a high resolution, you activate the peripheral visual area. We've done a lot of studies on this. It's been a lot of my labs. But this particular person did that. Spontaneous lie versus spontaneous truth. Again, we're getting a lot of activation back there for this person. Let me skip to this next person. This person, sorry, spontaneous lie versus spontaneous truth. It's not showing much of anything. So you've got one subject who appears to be visualizing in detail, and one who doesn't. But this subject is showing you a lot of activation. Okay. At this level, frontal lobe, which is probably involved in this information shutting stuff. So it looks like it's not just quantitative differences, but different people are actually doing different things. So if I leave you with one take-home message, let me summarize. This is for me, it's not for you, it's for me. Let me summarize what we've got here. Interpretations. Rehearsed lies elicit larger activation in these regions and the other conditions. Even spontaneous lies. Area 10 has been shown to be involved in retrievable episodic memory. It is probably harder to retrieve a lie if he's been taught the truth. Okay, so that's one thing that seems to generalize over subjects to some extent. Area 9, the reason I got confused before is I showed you area 9 first and area 10. I got flipped, I'm sorry. Area 9, anterior cingulate and the pulmonar. Spontaneous lies elicit larger activation than the other conditions. Area 9 has been implicated in working memory, which may be required to produce a spontaneous lie. You've got to keep in mind the truth, come up with something different. The right focus, right hemisphere, may be involved in keeping in mind visual scenarios per se, and the right-left difference in humans. The anterior cingulate has been implicated in conflict monitoring, as well as attentional processing. Spontaneous lies would require more attentional resources than the other conditions, which may correlate with working memory load. Furthermore, producing a spontaneous lie will also require inhibiting the truth as well as making sure that the lie differs from the truth. Anterior cingulate. Pulmonar has been implicated in attentional process, particularly attentional focusing, like Posner's scope. Fusiform gyrus, part of the web system. Lies have elicited more activation in general than truth. This structure appears to store visual memories per se, which are more difficult to activate than they're only recently learned. They also be involved in working memory as the visual part of the visual spatial specialist. Let's get to that. High-resolution images, which activate area V1, are used only some of the time as evidence for qualitative differences in strategies. General points. One, the theory has only loose heuristic value, but there do appear to be different processes underlying different sorts of lies. Okay. Two, some subjects follow the mean pattern, but some don't. I'm going to give one thought to keep in mind as you're considering lie detection. People's brains operate in different ways, both because they adopt different strategies in different circumstances, and also because there really are individual differences in how processes have gotten implemented in pretty wide swaths of the brain. Thanks.
Richard. Very interesting neuroscience, but it's rather discouraging point of view of lie detection.
Yeah.
Because what you're saying is that a perfect countermeasure is just learn the lie well enough.
Well, no. If you notice, there were differences.
Yeah, you didn't rehearse much. spy room, there's a lock.
Right.
They would get in the quiet rooms just like our real ones.
They create a false memory. So now what we have to ask is there a difference between a false memory and a real memory? According to my colleague Dan Schachter, there is. You know, the false memories have with them, don't have with them the sensory information that real memories do. Now I bet if he tells them to use imagery, when they're learning their false memories, you can actually get that in there too. And then, so that becomes a point where they get deluded and they actually start believing the false memory. So now what do you have? I don't know.
Can you train, can you ask a series of questions to learn the strategy? That is, I'm coming back to try to what there is here, that if I could create a pocket fMRI machine for the polygraph people.
Well, if you create it, we'll buy it.
Well, I'll sell it first.
There'll be a market for that.
And now the question is, so what could you implement? Well, if your story is follows through, then clearly we have to understand the strategy to start to unpack in order to be able to do the reverse conditioning to understand who's telling the truth and who isn't.
You probably can take a lot of the tools from standard cognitive psychology, response times under interference conditions, under various kinds of working memory load, and figure out what kind of strategy they're using. But we have to calibrate for each person separately. In fact, you can do this kind of thing for each person.
Right, and then ask them about the crime.
Exactly. So you can calibrate them up in advance. In fact, there are new technologies that are promising. They're not off the shelf. In fact, they came live here. They've been built. There's one called diffuse optical tomography, which George and I just ordered a machine instructor, which uses very weak lasers. That pulsing sounds bad, okay, but it's used with six-week-old infants. It's really safe. You get more, if you're me, no insulation on top here, you go outside a day like this, I get two orders of magnitude more going right through my skull from the sun than I do from these lasers, okay? So what the lasers do is put them through at two different frequencies. Usually it's about 760 or 780 nanometers and 820 near infrared. And it turns out that oxygenated hemoglobin absorbs more of one frequency, deoxygenated absorbs more of the other. So what you can do is you can put a bunch of these lasers in. It's a cap you put on, okay? And you pulse the different frequencies. So then you have these little fiber optic things, these optodes, and you can record how much light of we've got the frequency that 760 and 820, and then we've got the signature of which particular laser is being picked up from, 8,000 hertz or whatever, okay? So you're able to reconstruct where the source was and how much of that light got absorbed from a given optode. From that, you can actually reconstruct a lot of the same kind of data you get through fMRI, but it's just cortical. The light doesn't penetrate that deeply. So there are some people that are claiming they can get very fast response times out. It's almost EEG level temporal resolution, some people claim. This is controversial. But if it turns out to work, the thing is a helmet. It's fiber optic. You can have it out with no motion artifacts. The box is the size of that. Okay, it's no big deal at all. The custom-made one costs $120,000. If they mass produce one. So this is starting to sound like it might be plausible to do exactly what you had in mind, which is calibrate each person first, put it through, and then you run it through the thing. That's what I would do.
Well, I have a people who are different question. Some of the literature on behavioral kids deception suggests that each person has sort of different indicators, but they're relatively stable. Your mom knows when you're lying, but
nobody else does. My mom did, actually.
Is it likely to be true here as well, that people are different, but also they're relatively stable? So if you tested somebody 2 weeks from now, they show the same.
That is a super good question. Here's some more bad news for you. If you take an individual and you have them read words out loud, you have them do this four different blocks of trials, each of which is 90 seconds long. These are adults, so you can read six or five. Four sections of frontal lobes, and it stopped being activated in the back of the brain, whereas at the beginning, it was the other way around. So a single person, four blocks of trials, 90 seconds each. This is on top of this very, very well overlearned task. So the question is it a moving target? And the answer is probably yes. It's probably a moving target within a session,
between sessions, probably not, though. We brought him back 2 weeks later. People have not done this kind of work yet.
Then we just said...
Well, but the countermeasures could be...
No, but
we can bring back a week later.
But
if it turned out to be simple, I don't, the answer is I don't know.
But even over short spans of time, if you do the training first, what you see next may not match.
It may not. That's true. It has to be looked at. And as I say, there is potential bad news already in literature.
Yeah. That's...
And what if they ask you to lie during the calibration and you tell the truth? Same countermeasures.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't getting...
Well, we have behavior, though. So we make them say something out loud or push a button so we know whether they're lying or not during the calibration.
Because you know the stories.
Yeah. I mean, look, this very early days. I mean, the main thing I want to emphasize here is that there's a theoretical point that I think is worth thinking seriously, actually two. One is, it's probably not just lie versus not lie. It's probably different types of lies. This is just the thin edge of a wedge. We just looked at two different types, spontaneous and well-rehearsed from a coherent, memorized scenario. What about whether it's relative to somebody or something somebody else did? I bet that's going to turn out to be relevant, okay, from what we already know about this. But probably other dimensions. I thought of it. So A, it's not just lie versus not lie. B, big individual differences. And then there's probably other problems layered on top of those two that we haven't mined yet, these kind of things. So I'm sorry to be pessimistic, but I thought you should think about this.
Great, thank you. We appreciate your coming down and rushing back. Let's take 5 minutes and then we'll do a few left.
I knew you were 40 years ago.
I'm sure that we have a real schedule or not. You look like you have backups here. All these people behind you, but I think others will either join the circle room. For guests who are unaware who Sheila Reed is, hers is the name on two DARPA studies, among others, that the committee has looked at and discussed at length at its April meeting. A third study that we have read about and seen what we think of as a problem, we're not quite sure. And probably the source of other studies as well. And we've invited her to come and talk about those studies and her experiences doing research in this area.
Well, I thought I would change things around. I don't work in this field anymore, but it's not my day-to-day thing, and I don't have any particular axe to grind. I have the impression that people have some particular questions, so I thought I'd just start by letting you ask some questions. No questions, always I'm done.
Would you tell us a little bit about why you developed the TPS? I mean, what was the research background that helped you to develop that protocol?
That started out with working in the drug interdiction studies, where we had been tasked to come up with a polyglot task force. And I think I ran 5 studies on that called the CMP studies. And that's when we first started using the direct lie technique. We presented the CMP studies to one of the meetings of all of the agencies. And the agency has said, hey, that looks like a pretty good technique, and we've adapted for the counter intelligence scope. So we started working on developing a format that would work in that arena, kind of based on the format we had developed for the counter narcotics.
Are those earlier studies part of the public record?
Probably not.
Andy, do you remember?
I can bring it to the South Island.
Yeah, but...
Because the CNP 1, CNP 2, CNP 3, CNP 4, and CNP 5.
We just wouldn't have understood that they had an eruption. That's the reason why.
Some of those studies were the basis of developing this format. So, the agencies asked if we could adapt it to their kind of intelligence. So, that's what we did. We sat down with examiners, as well as the research staff, and tried to come up with a format. Most of the decisions were based on nothing more than, well, we do this here, let's do it here, and we do this here, we don't like it, so let's not do it, or those types of things. So there's not a whole lot of empirical foundation to some of the decisions.
When you say that you did these required studies, what was studied?
Some of the things that we started off looking at, we were trying to decide, okay, what type of scenario do we need to use. There were different small parameters that we were trying to test to see what was the most effective. I think one of the first CNP studies looked at directed lie versus probable lie, if I recall. So
were you doing validation studies? Were you doing just... When you say we were deciding which of these to use?
We would run scenarios and run a group of guilty, a group of innocent, have some with the directed lie control, some with the probable lie controls. I think we did some where we had different scenarios that we looked at. There were three or four things about running research and running scenarios and that type of thing that we played around with those first five studies. And frankly, it's been a few years, and I couldn't tell you exactly what each one was. But I know there were five studies run initially on the counter narcotics that led into us working on the SCNF study.
These were lab studies, is that correct?
Yes. All lab studies. So that's, you know, basically how the test format that developed. Sat down with examiners. There were a lot of decisions made to do things differently. One was to use the directed lie instead of the probable lie. Changed the testing sequence instead of asking, having one of the things that I did do that I think might have been important. We cut down the number of issues on the test. So whereas the typical screening format at that time asked four relevant totally separate issues on the same chart, the same test, we cut it down to two. So there are only two ish tests. And we cut it down so that we asked three repetitions on the same chart rather than having to do three separate charts. So the time sequence, the timing of it, the length of time it took to run it was cut down.
So the decision to cut from 42, was that made on an ad hoc basis, or did you have data that made you think it would be more accurate?
We had looked at, which is one of the questions, I think it was in Charles' study, didn't we look at whether or not you could identify the particular scenario that they did, and you couldn't. You couldn't, even though we might get them as deceptive, it wasn't necessarily deceptive to the crime that they had supposedly committed. So that got me thinking about, okay, and I looked at a specific issue test versus the screening test and what was going on, and it made sense to me that, hey, you're diffusing this person's attention all over the place. And when I tried to teach psychology to the polygraph school, one of the things I tried to get across was, look, these questions get their attention. If it gets their attention, and they're all over the place. So I thought cutting down the number of things that they're actually focusing on would make a difference. And in fact, before I left, I had been proposing you should do a single question test and focus on the one question. So that's how that came about.
There were two studies.
There were
three substantial studies of the TES.
yes.
that were randomized trials. Screw will appear as official dog pile reports, the third does not. Why does the third not?
I can only surmise. The third study was a very complex study. One of the things that I was focusing on in the third study was to try to find out the influence of the examiner bias on the results of the exam. So it was really a complicated study when we had different groups, and I would have one examiner do the pretest and then run the in-test or the actual polygraph test itself. And I had another group where one examiner would do the in-test, you know, setting it up and everything, and then a different examiner would come in and actually operate the equipment and do the actual test. And at each point, I would have the examiner indicate whether they thought the examinee was guilty or innocent.
I'm sorry, by the setup, you mean designing the control questions, for example, and setting up.
Right. So when they do these tests, they bring the examinee in, they talk about the instrument, how it works, they do what we term the acquaintance test, which is basically a technique to try to get the examinee to think that it works, type of stuff. And then they would tell them, they would review the questions with them and explain directed line controls and those sorts of things. So that's what I mean by the setup of it, the pre-test part. So I had, and then the different examiners would score the exams. I didn't really have a blind analysis because sometimes the person who did the pretest scored it, and sometimes the person who actually ran it scored it. So it wasn't a totally blind scoring in that particular situation. But there, I mean, it would have been too time consuming, and it wouldn't. But I mean, it would have required a whole lot more work to get that third. I